All right, so hopefully most of you now have that handout that Keila was passing through, the one with all the words on it. That's mostly going to be for taking home and using as a reference later on. But you should recognize the diagram on there. We've been showing that throughout periodically. And so as you have a chance to look at that in your hands and now up on the screen and reflect back on 10 chapters that we've been through in Daniel so far, I wanted to give you guys an opportunity to ask any questions or have any comments on anything we've covered up until this point. And Jerry would be more than happy to answer those questions for you, to field all of your bright questions from this very in-depth book. Are you guys following along so far?
Yeah.
Any thoughts or questions now that you have that whole handout in front of you? We've only showed parts of it up until now. Yes, Jerry.
Well, I need to apologize for last week that I went from trying to figure out how I was going to make chapter 10 last the whole class, and then somebody said I need to cover the last verses, the last four verses of chapter 9 also. So there was just too much to cover, and I feel like I did a terrible job, so sorry.
You did good, Jerry. You did good.
Yeah, no apologies needed. It's good.
There's too much.
There's a lot in there, yeah.
It's like you can take like 3 weeks a chapter on this stuff.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yep, I'm pushing it too fast.
Well, somebody catch me up. What did you learn in chapter 10? What are some bullet points?
Well, Daniel had that visitation. From Daniel. I think he was telling him about the kingdoms.
He didn't really get into it so much. He just was talking about how he was delayed. You remember why he was delayed?
Oh, yeah, the Prince of Persia.
Heavenly warfare.
Yeah, he got caught up in that spiritual warfare over Persia with some demonic force. And 3 weeks Daniel was praying, and 21 days he was held up, or perhaps the other way around is how it was worded. And he showed up and gave this revelation to Daniel, gave him some relief, an answer to his prayer. Any other thoughts or questions looking at that handout?
Jerry made very clear it was not Jesus.
That's true. It absolutely was not Jesus. We don't have too much detail on who it was. Perhaps it was Gabriel, but I don't think it specifically states that. That's just kind of an inference that I've made over time and others have made over time, but we're not told explicitly. That's just in my mind when I read that. That's Gabriel.
It's what?
Gabriel.
Verses 2 through 6 is Gabriel?
Of chapter 10?
Yeah. That reminds me of MacArthur's commentary says it's viewed as the pre-incarnate Jesus or Christ, a vision of.
Yeah, you know, some people will take that route.
A man clothed in linen with a belt of fine gold. His body was like beryl. His face like the appearance of light.
Yeah, I think
eyes, all that stuff right there.
Yeah, like people will look at Revelation 1 and the description of Christ there and make some comparisons. But again, it's not explicit. I feel a lot more comfortable ascribing that to Gabriel or some unnamed angel rather than to Christ, but people have done both. And we talked about back in chapter 3 when they were in the fiery furnace how that doesn't explicitly say that Christ was there either, but a lot of people will place Christ in that chapter, and perhaps he was, but we're just not certain on that. Yes, Tim.
I think the important thing to note is that he was this angel was waylaid by a demonic attack, which
is not something that's going to happen to Jesus specifically as God. God being all-powerful, Jesus being God, it doesn't leave any room for him to be waylaid in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah. He is the Almighty, right? Good.
Needing help as well from Michael, that's not something that would be... God needs help from no one, so anybody who make that, I would say, probably be, I'd argue, sacrilegious, but
yeah.
I see where it comes from. I think it would be outright wrong to say that.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. I think that's an erroneous position, but a lot of people who are way smarter than me hold to it. But that doesn't mean that I have to, right? I disagree with a lot of smart people, including John MacArthur, on several things. But he is far smarter, far brighter than I am. I just think he's wrong in some areas. Kilo, did you make sure that everybody else got those? I know that your mom walked in afterwards. All right. Well, if you peek at that handout in that section in chapter 11, you will notice that there's a division at verse 36. So I need to grab my copy. So you'll notice that over on the right side, where it says Daniel 11 and 12, down there in the section that starts with 331 BC Greece, it has outlined there for us the different sections, the different portions of chapter 11. And it goes up through Daniel 11:35. And then you have to jump all the way down to not just the Roman kingdom described by the iron, but even past that to the section described by iron and clay, where it says AD question mark. And then it picks up Daniel 11:36 through 45. So there's a change in the chapter, a shift in the time frame that we're looking at, that takes place there at Daniel chapter 36, or 11, verse 36, rather. And so to kind of blow up that section, that outline of chapter 11, I've put it up here. They have 11, verse 3, talking about Alexander the Great, and so that will be helpful to know going into it. And then 11, verses 5 through 20, speak of the kings of the south and the north. Now, if you think back to Daniel chapter 8 and even maybe reference this outline here, you'll remember that there was the ram and the goat that were mentioned in chapter 8. And the goat had the one horn, right? The mighty, conspicuous horn that represented Alexander the Great, who again is mentioned here in 11 verse 3. And then out of that one horn, remember the one horn was shattered, and four horns rose up in its place. And then from one of those four horns rose up another horn, a small horn that was insignificant to begin with. And that horn is representative of Antiochus Epiphanes, rather. And we'll read about him in this chapter also, in verses 21 through 35. And then later on in this chapter, in verses 36 through 45, this is going to be talking about the Antichrist. And so that's why there's that gap in time, going from the Greek Empire to the revived Roman Empire in a time that is still yet to come. And so that's just a little bit of an outline to prepare us as we get ready to dive into this chapter. This is a heavy chapter. And so that's why, one of the reasons why I don't think we're going to make it all the way through, but we will at least get started. So, looking at Daniel 11, we'll start in verse 1. It says, and this is the same speaker from chapter 10. So, whoever you want to imagine is speaking there in chapter 10, again, I think Gabriel is a high possibility. He's speaking here in chapter 11 also. It says, in the first year of Darius the Mede, so we find another time reference here right off the bat in verse 1. The first year of Darius the Mede, I arose to be an encouragement and a protection for him. So this messenger was acting as some sort of support for Darius. Verse 2 says, and now I will tell you the truth. behold, three more kings are going to arise in Persia. So remember, Darius, the Mede, we're told right there, was ruling in this second empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, represented by the silver in chapter 2, or by the bear in chapter 7, by the ram in chapter 8. This is the Medo-Persian Empire. And this messenger is telling Daniel that he's giving aid to Darius Mede, and he's now predicting that there are going to be three more kings who are going to arise in Persia after Darius. Then a fourth will gain far more riches than all of them. As soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. And so, after Darius the Mede, we'll have three more kings. And we know from history who these kings are. We're not going to spend a whole lot of time on them. If you want to jot down their names, there they are. Cambyses from 530 to 522. Pseudo-Smerdis from just in 522. He was short-lived. He wasn't even really the rightful heir to the throne. Darius the First, who, again, ironically, comes after Darius the Mede. So he's not really the first, but that's what he's called. Darius the First from 521 to 486. Those are the three kings that are mentioned there as following after Darius the Mede. And then the latter part of verse 2 says, then a fourth will gain far more riches than all of them. As soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse a whole empire against the realm of Greece. And we know this is Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, and he reigned from 485 to 465. And we read about him in Esther. He's the king who's on the throne in Esther and dealing with Esther and Mordecai and all that whole story. He's the one who we're dealing with there. And you might remember from chapter 1 of Esther that this king, King Ahasuerus, he was throwing a party, a big, huge party for 180 days. So 6 months he's throwing this party. Does anybody remember offhand the reason for his party? Very random reason. What's that?
Was it to try to find a wife, or was that?
Well, that was later. So that arose during that whole event.
Did he become king?
No. Sorry, I'm trying to think. What was his... Vashti was his wife's name. She refused to come in and dance during that party, and so then he had this whole wicked, evil scheme to find a new wife. But the reason for this party was to show off his riches. So 180 days, half a year, he was throwing this party so that he could display his riches of his royal glory. That's insane. Half a year to show people how much money he had and just keep bringing the booze, keep bringing the women, apparently, from what we can read into the text with Vashti and that whole ordeal and all the food and this big, massive, sick party. It would take me like 5 minutes to tell you guys, oh, this is all my stuff, right? And here are my vehicles, here's my house, and my net worth is very minimal. But no, it took him half a year to show off all of his wealth, to display his riches of his royal glory. And that's what we're reading about here. Again, prior to any of this happening, Daniel was writing in the 6th century, and he's saying, yeah, there's going to be three kings that come after Darius Mede, and then there's going to be a fourth, and he's going to have all kinds of money. And then what else does it say about this king who we know as Xerxes or Ahasuerus in verse 2? He's going to have a lot of money, and what else?
His teeth kicked in by Greece.
Yeah, he will arouse a whole empire against the realm of Greece. And yeah, we can surmise from what we've learned in chapter 2 and chapter 7, chapter 8 especially, that yes, he will indeed get his teeth kicked in. He fought multiple wars against Greece. At one time, he amounted an army of over 2 million people to come up against Greece. And that's just a crazy number. That's a number that's comparable to the number of Allied men who stormed the beaches of Normandy. And this is not a modern war, right? This was centuries and centuries ago. He came up against Greece with 2 million men, and he fell. Even with that great amount of might, he wasn't poking a bear. Remember, he was a bear who was poking a leper, if we take the imagery from chapter 7. Or if we take the imagery from chapter 8, he was a ram who was poking the goat, right? In fact, let's go back and read a little bit from chapter 8, and we'll see that he really upsets Greece. He upsets Alexander the Great, the male goat. So Daniel 8, we'll go ahead and start in verse 5. It says, "While I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, and the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes." Again, this is Greece, and the horn is Alexander the Great. "He came up to the ram to Medo-Persia that had two horns, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him in his mighty wrath." So he was angry, right? Because he had just had this 2 million-man army come up against him. "I saw him come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him, and he struck the ram and shattered his two horns, and the ram had no strength to withstand him. So he hurled him to the ground and trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram from his power." So Alexander the Great didn't respond well to Xerxes coming up against him all these times, as we're told here in chapter 11 that he would. Again, all this is prophesied beforehand. Yes, Joseph.
So you're saying Xerxes was the same guy that is in the story of Esther.
Uh-huh.
And so, but he's like he's the king of the Medo-Persians? Or?
Yes.
And so I guess he was the king. He had that kingdom with Esther too.
Yep. Yeah, she was given a great privilege, right? She was raised up for such a time as this to be in that position of power, to be influencing the king over this mighty nation, this empire. But he was going to fall to Alexander the Great, not to Rome, to Greece.
Yeah, so did the Esther story happen before this?
Before the fulfillment of this, yes.
Okay.
But Daniel was written beforehand, prophesying what was going to take place afterwards.
Oh. Okay.
Yep. Yes, Jerry.
Well, just going back to the 2 million man army that had been in any time. The logistics of managing that many people is incomprehensible to us. But in those days, I mean, where everybody's...
No radios or walkie-talkies.
Around, where are they going to get all their food? Where are they going? I mean, you get an army that big, it has the capacity of destroying itself.
Absolutely.
Because where are you going to get food and water, especially in that climate for that many people? It's...
Yeah. And oftentimes we're very generous in using the word man when talking about a 2 million man army. Remember, these were most likely young boys, right? Teenage boys who were.
Yes.
But yeah, 2 million, that's just a massive number to try to orchestrate so much going on there. But yeah, he did it, just not successfully.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's continue on. Verse 3. It says, speaking of Alexander the Great, that a mighty king will arise, and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. And indeed, Alexander did just that. He ruled from Europe to India. He conquered and reigned, and he did so quickly and swiftly. Remember, like the leopard who moved quickly and ferociously. He did just that. Less than 4 years, he conquered this kingdom. Verse 4. Says, but as soon as he has arisen, so not long, again, 4 years, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants, nor according to his authority which he wielded, for his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others besides him. So as we mentioned before, when we were covering this in chapter 7 and 8, Alexander, when he died, his kingdom didn't go to one of his descendants, but they came to him on his deathbed and they said, "What do we do with your kingdom?" And he said, we'll give it to the strong. And so they divided it up to his four generals, one in each direction, as we read, to the north, south, east, and west. And they took that kingdom and they ruled it. And that's what we saw back in chapter 7, verse 6, when we saw the four heads of the leopard. They were representative of these four kings or four generals that would take this kingdom. Or in 8:8, when we saw these four horns that came up out of this shattered horn. Again, they represent the four generals that took over Alexander's army. But today we're just going to focus on two of them primarily. We're going to focus on the kings of the south and the kings of the north. And so the kings of the south are representative of Egypt. And I gave you that handout, and it shows on one side, the side with less words on it, the Ptolemies. It was the Ptolemaean Empire. And you'll see that there are six Ptolemies there. Ptolemy the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth. And they have names and dates there to go with them. But when we're reading through this text, it's just going to say the king of the south, or reference his son or one who came after him. And so the names and the actual kings are going to vary, but the nation stays the same. That's what's going to be consistent. The king of the south is Egypt. So that's what you need to get into your mind. And then the kings of the north are going to be referring to Syria, to that section of the Grecian Empire that went to Syria. And this will cover the Seleucids and Antiochuses. There are four kings that go by each of those names. So there's Seleucus the first, Antiochus the first, Antiochus the second, Seleucus the second, Seleucus the third, Antiochus the third, Seleucus the fourth, and Antiochus the fourth. Just these different kings taking over in this northern kingdom of Syria. And so we're going to be going back and forth looking at those two sections of the Grecian Empire. And so these kings will change, and we're not going to mess too much with the names because I know there's a lot going on here, and that's what this printout is for, because there's a lot of details in there, and I'm not going to cover all the names. There's just a lot to try to keep up with there. And so I printed that out for you so you could have that. That comes from the Bible Knowledge Commentary. That's from Dwight Pentecost's notes on 11:5-20. And I've showed you this before, but I want to show you again because that's a great commentary, a great two-volume commentary. It's very, I know it looks big, but it's very small because it covers the whole Bible. That's the Old Testament, that's the New Testament. And they got some of the best authors and most studied people for each book to write on that. At home I have two shelves probably this wide of John MacArthur's commentaries just on the New Testament. So probably 4, maybe 5 feet of shelf space covering just the New Testament, just by one man. And I think that this is probably a more valuable work because it's more detailed, more specific, and people spent a lot more time studying in depth those different books. And again, this goes through the Old and New Testament. So if you don't have that reference, that's a good resource for you to get. And so again, there are going to be six kings in Egypt over this time frame, just from verses 5 to 20, and eight kings in the north, in Syria, over the same time period. Any thoughts or questions before we get into it? All right. Sam was looking at me like he wanted to say something. Go ahead.
Who was the books that you just held up?
There are many different authors in there. So each different book has a different author. Walward and Zook are the general editors on that. It's the Bible Knowledge Commentary is what it's called. And so, yeah, we'll take different authors for different books. Give you the best of the best.
Best one, two thumbs up.
Okay.
Two thumbs up. Good. All right, so I'm not going to get into too much detail. As I mentioned, that's why I gave you this handout, because there's a ton of detail in there. However, I do want you to recognize as we go throughout this section that there is a lot of detail in here. We don't have to necessarily pick apart all the parts and go back and look at it historically as Dwight Pentecost does, but I do want us to contemplate and consider why there's so much detail in there. So before we even get in there and look at all this great detail, we've already looked at four verses where we see a lot of detail, right? Talking about these three kings that will come up after Darius and Mede, and then a fourth, and he's going to have all these riches and rule with his riches, and then he's going to go into Greece and come up against Greece, turn the whole nation against Greece. Why do you suppose that there's so much detail in this chapter? That wasn't a rhetorical question. God did want it to be there. Good. And can we...
Inspired it.
It is inspired. Good.
Well, and two, so you can make no doubt. I mean, that's pretty specific. And if this is beforehand, then there's no denying when you look back. That's exactly what he said was going to happen, and it did.
Good. Yeah, so it's there for verification purposes, right? So we can look back and see, oh, man, look, this came from God. This had to have come from God, right? And it was concerning, he was the messenger, whoever was speaking to Daniel, was speaking to him because Daniel was concerned with his people, with his nation, Israel. What is going to happen with my nation? There's all these other Gentile kingdoms that are going to rise up, and looks like a lot of oppression is coming our way. What's the future of Israel hold? And this has a lot to do with what Israel has to expect. But yeah, it validates the word of God, that it is coming from God, and it is very specific. It's been said that there are upwards of 135 specific prophecies that are fulfilled just in this chapter alone, in chapter 11. And I can't go through and verify all that, but there's so much detail in here that I can definitely see that being true. I have no reason to doubt that. And again, we've talked about before how so many people question the validity of Daniel, and they want to put him after the fact and date him after the fact, say that he was writing in 200 BC rather than 600 BC, or 2nd century rather than 5th century. And we have to remember that we have so much evidence that we can point to and say, oh, well, this, even in chapter 11, there were things that happened in chapter 11 that came after the Septuagint, which was the Greek translation of the Old Testament, which Daniel is a part of. We have writings in the Dead Sea Scrolls that predate some of the events here in chapter 11. But the biggest reason why we should accept Daniel is because Jesus accepted Daniel. And if Daniel was in fact written after the fact, then it would have been to intentionally mislead people, to he would be trying to act like it was written beforehand when he knew full well that it wasn't. It would have been fraudulent, and Jesus would have been duped by this fraudulent piece of pseudo-history. And if that's the case, then what are we even doing here? So Jesus gave credence to Daniel. We should give credence to Daniel as well.
I have a note here, and I have no idea. I wish I had written down some sort of reference or something, but it says something about the tradition, there being a tradition of the high priest showing this passage to Alexander the Great as he, like this particular section right here about Alexander the Great coming, showing it to Alexander the Great as he went through and conquered Judea. Have you heard anything like that?
I've heard, I don't know if there's a scriptural reference for that, but we see something similar with Cyrus too. I think that might be documented in Jeremiah. Maybe it's not, but yeah, I've heard of that. I just don't have specifics on that.
I mean, if that's something that happened, then it would guarantee that this happened before Daniel was at least written, well before the
sure.
Greeks went through.
Yeah. There's a lot of circumstantial evidence, like maybe not circumstantial, but secondary evidence like that. But again, I think the greatest evidence we have is the testimony of Jesus saying, remember Daniel the prophet, when he spoke about the abomination of desolation, you need to listen to him, and whoever does that and has wisdom will prevail, or something to that extent. That needs to be the number one reason why we accept Daniel, but there are plenty of other reasons why we should accept him as well. All right. Looks like I forgot to press a button there. Oh, These two nations were constantly warring against one another for a period of over 200 years. So even though we can read through this section in a matter of seconds, it took over 200 years for all this to play out. So that's very important to keep in mind. And again, looking at these two nations we're going to be focusing on, the kings of the south and the kings of the north, why do you suppose they're called the kings of the south and the kings of the north? The north and south of what, Joseph?
The north of Israel and the south of Israel.
All right, good. We have to keep that in mind, right? Everything is relative to Israel. Daniel is getting this information because he's concerned about Israel. And the north is Syria. They're north of Israel. And Egypt is to the south of Israel. So that's important to realize again as we're going through this. In Isaiah 46, 9 through 10, it says, "Remember the former things long past, for I am God and there is no other." That is one of the reasons why I think we have so much detail in Daniel 11, so that we can remember God is God alone. He says, "I am God, there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times, things that have not been done, saying, my purpose will be established, and I will accomplish all my good pleasure." He knew what he was doing. He could tell the end from the beginning. He is unique and set apart, and he has given verifiable evidence of that. All right. Jerry.
You just asked why there should be so much detail in here. Compare it to Jesus doing all the miracles. It's just a huge range of miracles, from simple things of just healing someone, to raising Lazarus from the dead after 4 days. He did all of that to absolutely verify to anyone who had eyes to see and ears to hear about who Jesus really is.
Yeah.
So by giving this much detail, to me it's always amazing that all this detail about the Gentiles is given to Daniel, because he asked about his nation. And of course they were disbanded, they were dispersed at this at his time. And so all those details are proof, once they've happened, that his words were absolute, but also that the last words that he said, which haven't happened yet to us, still absolutely true, and it will happen exactly that way.
Yeah, in a literal sense. All these other things happen literally, so we shouldn't look for a spiritual allegorized fulfillment. We should look for a fulfillment that is in line with the way that these previous things were fulfilled.
So when John wrote Revelation 600 years later, it just fills in the blanks of Daniel's last sentences there.
Amen. Good point.
Yeah, it's all there for anybody to see unless they just refuse to.
Amen. All right, well, let's continue to read and we will see it. And this is a lot of information. Don't get overwhelmed. We'll take it piece by piece. So verses 5 and 6, we'll start there. Says, "Then the king of the south," which is what?
The Ptolemies.
Yeah, good. In Egypt, right? Yeah, so the king's names are going to change a little bit. So I'm going to focus primarily on the nation. So the king of the south of Egypt, he will grow strong, along with one of his princes, who will gain ascendancy over him and obtain dominion. His dominion will be a great dominion indeed. After some years, they will form an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south, or of Egypt, will come to the king of the north, or Syria, to carry out a peaceful arrangement. But she will not retain her position of power, nor will he remain with his power, but she will be given up, along with those who brought her in and one who sires her as well as he who supported her in those times." So this whole section is like a crazy soap opera drama. There's a lot going on. And it's just intensified by all these confusing names. Again, you can take Pentecost commentary and read through that. A lot of detail, a lot of good stuff, but it's hard for me to keep names straight. So we're just going to, again, go with Egypt and Syria for the most part. So, and by the way, all this is verifiable, not just in the Bible Knowledge Commentary, but you can pick up an encyclopedia, you can go to Wikipedia. There is so much documented history here, and this is given to Daniel ahead of time, and it's well documented in even secular history. And so one of the Ptolemies, Ptolemy II, the king of the south, Egypt, he gives his daughter Bernice to Antiochus II, who is king of the north, Syria. This was a common practice, is what we read about in the first part of verse 6. They're just trying to come to a peaceful arrangement. And so the idea is, hey, if my daughter's over there, I'm not going to attack that nation, right? And on the other side, it's like, hey, I have his daughter, that's my father-in-law. We're homies, right? We need to be at peace with one another, not be at war with each other. So common practice. And it says in the text that she will not retain her position of power. Well, what does this mean? We can, again, turn to secular history, and we can see that in order for Antiochus II to marry Bernice, who was given to him, he had to first divorce his wife, Laodice. And Laodice didn't really like that. She's like one of those crazy ladies from that TV show Cheaters, and she's going to go out and get her revenge on Bernice. And so she goes and she has Bernice killed and her young son killed, and then she poisons Antiochus II, her ex-husband, before turning around and making her own son king in his place. So again, crazy soap drama or soap opera drama going on here. We can boil all that down to say that verses 5 and 6 talk about how Egypt pursues alliance with Syria, but it fails, right? Because this crazy lady wants to kill a bunch of people. Picking up in verse 6, let's see. So it says halfway through verse 6, but she will not retain her position of power, nor will he remain with his power, but she will be given up, along with those who brought her in and the one who sired her, as well as he who supported her in those times. Verse 7, but one of the descendants of her line will arise in his place, and he will come against their army and enter the fortress of the king of the north, and he will deal with them and display great strength. This is talking about Bernice's brother, Ptolemy III. He went up to Syria and he avenged his sister and his nephew and displayed great strength in doing so. He took over the throne and put them back in their place. And just in case this is starting to sound like an old Jerry Springer episode or Forensic Files episode that you saw one time, again with all the nasty drama, we can look in verse 8 and be reminded that this is completely separate because it talks about their gods being taken away to Egypt. It says in verse 8, although also their gods with them, with their metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold, he will take into captivity to Egypt. And he, on his part, will refrain from attacking the king of the north for some years. Let's just keep going. It says, then the latter will enter the realm of the king of the south, but he will return to his own land. His sons will mobilize and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one of them will keep on coming and overflow and pass through, that he may again wage war up to his very fortress. The king of the south will be enraged and go forth and fight with the king of the north. Then the latter will raise a great multitude, and that multitude will be given into the hand of the former. When the multitude is carried away, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cause tens of thousands to fall, yet he will not prevail. For the king of the north will again raise a greater multitude than the former, And after an interval of some years, he will press on with a great army and much equipment. And so, all that to say, there's going to be a lot of wars going on, right? There's going to be battle after battle. The north and the south, for hundreds of years, they're going to be fighting against each other. Egypt and Syria are going to be fighting with one another. And once again, Daniel is being told about this hundreds of years in advance. These wars are just going to be going back and forth, power shifting from Syria to Egypt and back from Egypt to Syria. And why is all this war important to Daniel? Why does he care about all this war going on?
It's destroying the land of Israel.
Yeah.
The cities, they're fighting back and forth.
Yeah, Israel's caught in the middle, aren't they?
The middle.
You got Syria up here and Egypt down here, and they hate each other. They're back and forth and very detailed about going back and forth and wars and battles and tens of thousands falling. And Israel's caught in the middle of all of this. And we'll see in verse 14, they kind of get sucked into all this drama a little bit. It says in verse 14, "Now in those times, many will rise up against the king of the south, the violent ones among your people." That's a reference to Israel. "The violent ones among your people will also lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they will fall down." So Israel gets involved in the drama, and they pay for it. They begin choosing sides for a moment, aligning themselves with Syria against Egypt, but in the end, they fall. We could speculate that perhaps they were doing this to try to find favor in the eyes of Syria, but that ultimately doesn't work. If we keep reading in verse 15, we see that the king of the north will come, cast up a siege ramp, and capture a well-fortified city, and the forces of the south will not stand their ground, not even their choicest troops, for there will be no strength to make a stand. But he who comes against him will do as he pleases, and no one will be able to withstand him. He will also stay for a time in the beautiful land with destruction in his hand. So that reference of the beautiful land is a reference to Israel. So they get caught up in this and doesn't go well for them. Verse 17 says that he will set his face to come with the power of his whole kingdom, bringing with him a proposal of peace, which he will put into effect. He will also give him the daughter of woman to ruin it, but she will not take a stand for him or be on his side. So now we see here that the Syrian king now tries to send his daughter down to Egypt to make an alliance with the Egyptian king. But the Egyptians, like the Egyptians had done before, but they were doing it deceitfully. He was doing it to ruin it. However, it ends up backfiring, and she doesn't follow through. She ends up siding with her new husband rather than with her dad, the Syrian king. Verse 18 says, "Then he, the king of Syria, will turn his face to the coastlands and capture many. But a commander will put a stop to his scorn against him. Moreover, he will repay him for his scorn." And so he had this ploy to send his daughter into Egypt. That didn't work. That backfired on him. And so he turns his attention to the coastlands, to Asia Minor, and seeks to gain some more power there, but he encounters some resistance. A new kid on the block who's showing up and throwing his weight around. Any idea who this might be? This person who offers some resistance to this king of Syria, this one of these four horns from the Grecian Empire. He comes up against Rome. This is speaking about Rome. Remember that Egypt and Syria are just two of the little horns that come up out of the conspicuous horn represented by Alexander the Great, the goat of Greece. And as we learned in chapter 2 and chapter 7, Greece falls to Rome, right? And we're starting to see some resistance from Rome as Rome seeks to expand its power, specifically the Syrian king. And so the Syrian king failed in his attempt to trick Egypt with his daughter. He ultimately failed in conquering Asia Minor. And so this king, Antiochus III, he gets upset after Rome's intervention. He plunders his own people, Syria, just out of frustration and being upset. And they end up murdering him, desecrating his body, and hiding it so that it can't be recovered or buried. We read about this in verse 19. Again, before any of this ever happened, it said, so he, after these two failures, he will turn his face toward the fortress of his own land, but he will stumble and fall and be found no more. Then in verse 20, we read about one more king who rises up. He overtaxes the people and is quickly poisoned. As it says in verse 20, he is shattered, though not in anger or in battle. And he has a relatively short reign. That's a lot in verses 5 through 20. Any thoughts or questions on the back and forth between Egypt and Syria in 5 through 20?
Do you have any more notes after verse 14?
No, I do not. Not for that section. Thanks for asking, though, because I often forget. All right, so going back to our outline, we've covered those first few sections, Alexander the Great, kings of the south and the north. Now let's turn our attention to 21 through 35 as we consider Antiochus Epiphanes. That's a name that should be somewhat familiar to us by now. We've talked about him a little bit before. We talked about him back even in Mark 13 when we were talking about the abomination of desolation. And more recently in Daniel chapter 8, he was the little horn that grew up out of the one of the four horns after the great horn, Alexander the Great, was shattered. Let's go back and read that section in Daniel 8. I'll read verses 8 and 9. It says, then the male goat magnified himself exceedingly, but as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken, and in its place there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. Out of one of them came forth a rather small horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the beautiful land. And so that horn is Antiochus Epiphanes. We're going to take another look at him here in chapter 11. I think that he, as I mentioned before, he prefigures the Antichrist who is to come. Not synonymous with the little horn of chapter 7, but I think he prefigures the Antichrist. In fact, he was called the Antichrist of the Old Testament. Antiochus Epiphanes was. I remember that we read quite extensively about him from 1 Maccabees chapter 1, that apocryphal book, and it talked about all the wicked things that he had done, how he came in and he destroyed the temple, how he came in and he refused worship, how he outlawed feasts and circumcision, how he would take circumcised babies and have them killed and their parents for having them circumcised, how he wouldn't let anybody own the Old Testament scriptures. How he was sacrificing pigs in the temple and force-feeding pig to the Jews who couldn't eat pig. How he erected an altar to Zeus in the temple. He killed 80,000 Jews and enslaved just as many. He was a very evil, wicked man. And he's the one that we're dealing with here, verses 21 through 35. In chapter 11, verse 21... It says that, referring to the previous king who had just gone off the scene, it says, in his place a despicable person will arise, on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred, and he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue. And so Antiochus, he is the little horn from chapter 8, but also he wasn't in line to be king, but he seized the throne by force. He just took it, even though his father wasn't king. And he was embraced as king because he defeated an invading army. And so people were okay with him because he was powerful, and they accepted and embraced him as king. Verse 22 says that the overflowing forces will be flooded away before him, and shattered, and also the prince of the covenant. After an alliance is made with him, he will practice deception and will go up and gain power with a small force of people. In a time of tranquility, he will enter the richest parts of the realm, and he will accomplish what his fathers never did, nor his ancestors. He will distribute plunder, booty, and possessions among them, and he will devise his schemes against strongholds, but only for a time. So he gained popularity among the people of Israel, with his socialistic tactics, right? He was taking from the rich and giving to the poor, and he was gaining popularity for because of these tactics. Verse 25 says that he, again, Antiochus Epiphanes, he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south, that's Egypt, with a large army. And the king of the south will mobilize an extremely large and mighty army for war. But he will not stand, for schemes will be devised against him. Those who eat his choice foods will destroy him, and his army will overflow, and many will fall down slain. As for both kings, their hearts will be intent on evil, and they will speak lies to each other at the same table, but it will not succeed, for the end is still to come at the appointed time. Then he will return to his land with much plunder, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant, and he will take action and then return to his own land. So there's really not a whole lot of new going on here. Same story, right? He's coming up against the king of the south, and he is the king of the north, king of Syria. So north and south continue to fight. He plunders the king of the south, the Pharaoh of Egypt. And we read that they sit down at the same table in verse 27. They try to come to some sort of agreement, but they're both operating dishonestly, right? They're just politicking. This is diplomacy at its finest, just trying to scheme against one another. And Antiochus ends up heading back to Syria, but he takes out some of his frustration on Israel along the way. We read in 28 that he will return to his land with much plunder, but he will be set against the Holy Covenant and take action and then return to his own land. So again, Israel is kind of getting caught up in the middle of this war between Egypt and Syria that's been going on now for hundreds of years. Verses 29 and 30. This is interesting here. It says that at the appointed time, he, Antiochus Epiphanes, the king of Syria, will return and come into the south. But this last time, it will not turn out the way that it did before, for ships of Kittim will come against him. Now, this reference to Kittim, or to Cyprus, your Bibles might say, or to Rome. That's who we're talking about here. So the ships from Rome come up against him. Therefore, he will be disheartened and will return and become enraged at the Holy Covenant, or Israel, and take action. So he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. And so he's coming up against Egypt once again, but ships from Kittim, from Cyprus, from Rome come up to stop him. Now, Rome, they were getting their grain from Egypt. And Antiochus is coming into Egypt and he's threatening to disrupt their whole system. And they're not going to have any of that. And so they're not about to let Antiochus interrupt their trade agreement. And so similar to how Antiochus III was prevented by a Roman general, now Antiochus IV, Antiochus Epiphanes, he comes into a sticky situation being met not only by a Roman general, but a Roman general who is accompanied by a fleet of Roman ships. And history tells us that Antiochus was warned that he needed to back down. He needed to leave Egypt and get out of there. And so he was approached by Rome saying, get out of here. And Antiochus asked for some time to think about it. And the general took out and drew his sword. And he drew a circle in the sand around Antiochus. And he said that before you cross this line in the sand, you will either be at peace with Rome or you're going to be at war with Rome. And so Antiochus was put in this situation where he had to decide. Ultimately, he came to the conclusion that he was outnumbered, and he agreed to go home with his tail between his legs. He was embarrassed, and the text says in verse 30 that he was embittered and enraged at the Holy Covenant. So he had some misplaced anger toward Israel because Rome stepped in and said, no, you're not going to take over Egypt. And so he goes and in humiliation, Antiochus retreated. He took out his anger on the Holy Covenant, as we read in verse 30, and on the sacred fortress, like we read in verse 31. And this is really where we can fit First Maccabees chapter 1 into here, him taking out all of his frustration on not only the people of Israel, but on the temple itself. We're told by, I don't remember if it's in First Maccabees 1 or elsewhere, but he took human feces and mixed it with pig feces and smeared it all around in the temple. Again, he put a altar to Zeus in the temple. He took a pig and slaughtered a pig in the temple and offered it on the altar. He just desecrated the sacred fortress. And verse 32 says that by smooth words he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly toward the covenant, but the people who know their God will display strength and take action. So he was seeking to actively turn people away from Yahweh, from the God of Israel. And many people did. They turned to godlessness, but there were those who displayed great strength and took action. This is where the whole story of the Maccabees and the Maccabean revolt comes into play. How they stood up and they said, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to play that game. And when I read of that encounter, I think of the movie Red Dawn. There are a couple of versions of it, just talking about how there's this small group of people and they refuse to give in to this invading army. And so they're kind of off in the hills, running around, just doing their own little thing. And that's really what a remnant of the Jewish people were doing. They were refusing to give in to Antiochus, to this Antichrist of the Old Testament, who is prefiguring an even worse Antichrist who is yet to come. Verse 33 says, those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many. Yet they will fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity and by plunder for many days. Even those faithful, they're going to fall. Now when they fall, they will be granted a little help, and many will join with them in hypocrisy. Some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and make them pure until the end time, because it is still to come at the appointed time. Now when it speaks of the end which is to come, it's speaking of the persecution of the people, the persecution of the temple, of the beautiful land. And back in 8:14, Daniel was told that this end will come, and it will come in for 2,300 evenings and mornings, and then the holy place will be properly restored. So this persecution that Israel was undergoing, it was for this specific period of time, and then it will come to an end. And next week, we'll take a look at the end of chapter 11 and consider the Antichrist who is yet to come. And then we'll wrap up with just the short 13 verses of chapter 12. And we are out of time, so if you have thoughts or questions, save them until next week. Let's go ahead and pray. God, thank you again for your word. Help us to make sense out of all these details and all this information, and above all, to remember that you are King, you are Lord, that you are without beginning, without end, that there is nothing that takes place without your ordaining it, and that you are in charge of all things. You are in charge of kings and nations. You are in charge of us, and you care about us. God, what a blessing. What a mind-blowing thought. God, we love and praise you. Amen.